Well, of course, from all the way from Casa Bay, Florida. So I'm now going to turn the moon over to Colin Fish to explore it.
Thank you. I want to first of all thank the committee for asking me to come here. We're here to talk about mummies, I guess. And I suppose a good way to start is to talk about how I got here, me being mummy number one up here at this moment. We like to talk about ourselves. And I want to talk about miracles tonight also. But I think, first of all, it's a miracle that I am here. And secondly, I think it's a miracle that any of us are here. But I'll tell you one thing, I'm rather a freak in this AA association. And as much as I came to a fellowship that didn't yet exist, when I came to this fellowship that was not yet known as Alcoholics Anonymous, I came into the old Oxford movement. Same movement that Bill Wilson and Doc Smith were introduced to. And eventually, AA evolved from this. It is a miracle the way I got here. Let me tell you a few things about it. I had, at the time, I had been married to a gal who was a member of a very Spanish family. And this family seemed to congregate around my home most of the time. I'd have one, two, three, or four of them in there. And these people, as I say, were very clannish, and they used to have a lot of family conferences. And these conferences were among them. I was never invited to them because I was usually the subject under consideration. David alternately throw me out of my house and then he went and let me back in. But finally, the last conference of all conferences was taking place, and the upshot of the whole thing was that I would be able to stay in my own home, providing that I would go to work for my wife's brother. He had a large truck. He had a tractor-trailer outfit. He hauled merchandise from Cleveland to New York and back. And I was supposed to break in and become his helper. Well, I was never on a truck in my life, and the idea of driving one of those big outfits was quite frightening to me. And it also suggested hard work, and that was likewise frightening. I had not worked for a good long time, and I was what you might call unemployable. And if you don't believe I was unemployable, I will give you a couple of examples. In the first place, during those years, it was the years of depression, and Roosevelt was president during one of his terms. And during this time, Roosevelt backed this WPA plan, where men were to go to work and do whatever they could, or make believe they're working, and for this they would get $18 a week. All of my drug buddies got on this WPA kick, and they wouldn't take me. Now, any of you folks who are old enough to know anything about WPA, you think of a fellow who would not even qualify for it. I would say he is a pretty sorry lot. I have maintained a resentment toward Roosevelt ever since then. Well, if that isn't bad enough, my wife had always been acutely interested in my going to work, and she did everything she could do. You know what her job was? She worked, she had it, the family had to eat. And her job, she was the head of the men's department in an employment bureau. And she couldn't get me a job. Well, I would say I wasn't very much as far as employment was concerned. Well, things rocked on, and his brother-in-law took me with him on a trip to New York, where I was to learn to be a truck driver. He fixed up this little sleeper cab of his so that I was to sleep up in the back and he would sleep on the seat when any sleepiness would be gone. He fixed it up real nice to put a curtain in the window and everything for me. It was real sweet. And we started off for New York, and it was cold weather when we started off. It was beginning of winter. Everything happens to me in the lousiest of weather, and this was no exception. We started for New York, and he drove all night long, and I thought, well, this man never stopped. He didn't know it, but I had a few dimes secreted around in my various pockets so they wouldn't rattle. He didn't know I had in capital. And he drove all day the next day, and the following evening he hit Albany, New York, and he really wore out, so he had to take a rest. So he pulled his outfit over to the side of the street and said, I'm going to take a nap here for an hour. I said, fine, this is the capital of New York State. I always wanted to see the Capitol building. So this was the first chance I had to get away from him. And I got out of that truck and I ran down the street and got into the first place I could find, but I found that was not a place that was suitable to a man of my estate. So I moved on to another one and found one that was more suitable. And I got in this joint and I found an angel. And I was throwing those things in me as fast as they came. And I went out the back door. Started down the street toward the truck and I hadn't had a drink for 2 days. Which is some kind of a record. And he hit me all at once. So when I started climbing up into this truck, I stepped on his poor boy's face. And of course, he knew what was up and church was out. So he carried me on into New York City, and he took this outfit of his down on the waterfront, and he threw me out, and there he left me, and he told me that's the end of the line, and that's the end of me. Well, I'm in New York. I'm 600 miles away from home. I don't have a dime. I don't have anything. I don't have an overcoat. I have no wardrobe. I sold all that long hence. And I had to figure out a way to exist. So I thought of another sister of his who lived out in Yonkers. And this, I thought, certainly Virginia owed me something. She used to come to my home and she stayed there a long time at one time and she had an operation. I took care of all these things for some years previously. And I figured she'd look after me, do something for me. And I knew where she lived in Yonkers because I was there on my honeymoon. I say this is a very clanny family. They did everything together. Well, I made it out to Yonkers and I remember she used to live way up on top of a hill. But you know, I didn't go up on a hill, by the way. I went down a hill. And I got down there in the Italian section, and I met some very interesting new friends. And we all got into this Dago Red. And by the time I got up to Virginia's house, I guess I was a sight for sore eyes. I can only remember a few things about that trip to her home. I remember rolling around on the floor with her two little daughters, her little kids. They were just youngsters, 3, 4 years old. And I was dirty, I was drunk, and I stunk. And Virginia took a dim view of this performance, so she took me in the back of her car, and she drove me back down to the waterfront from whence I came and threw me out where her brother had done. And there I was. I shall never forget that day, because I think this is the day that I realized this is the loneliest day of my life. I remember standing on that waterfront, and what occurred to me was that there wasn't one person in this whole world who cared one bit whether I was alive or dead. I had no more friends, I had no more family, I had no nothing. This was the end of the line. So I had to exist, and I found a way to do it in New York. Whenever you're in a bad way, there's a town with more suckers per square mile than any place in the world. And if you have any wits at all, which the alky usually has, you can get along. And I did get along for a long time there. I tell the story for a reason. Sometime later, Virginia had the doctor to her home for one of the kids. Of course, I knew nothing about this. And they got to talking about drinking, which always seemed to be a favorite subject among society. And Virginia related a story to her doctor about my visit to her and what a nice guy I used to be, her favorite brother-in-law, and what a dirty, stinking, drunken bum I am now. The doctor said, well, that's odd. He says, I had a brother-in-law with a drunk, and he got mixed up with some strange cult of people. And since he got mixed up with these people, he hasn't drank anymore. He don't drink anymore, and he runs around trying to fix other drunks. And he says, likewise, there's a doctor, a medical doctor down in Akron, Ohio, who is also a drunk and is quit, and he spends all of his time fixing drunks. We used to call it fixing in those days. So he says, if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can get on Akron and meet this doctor, and his doctor can fix him. So, of course, I don't know this is going on. But apparently, Virginia relayed this information to Dorothy back in Cleveland, and eventually I made my way back to Cleveland a year or so later, and I... It was still winter time, another winter it was, though. And I charged up on the front porch of where I lived. I hoped to get in the nest. And Dorothy met me at the door, and there's snow about 4 feet deep out there. And I noticed when I went up on the porch, the screen doors were still up, and the screens were up. And she was talking to me through this screen door. And I pointed this thing out to her. I pointed out the fact that she needed a man around the house to take care of such details. And she allowed as though she did need a man around the house, but she sure didn't need one that badly. So I didn't get in. But she did tell me about this Dr. Smith, Dr. Bob Smith in Akron, Ohio, who fixes drunks, and asked me if I'd like to get out and meet him. But what could I lose? I wasn't going to get in the nest, and I might as well try whatever I could get. So I said, yes, I'd like to meet this doctor. So Dorothy put me in her car. They're always riding me someplace, this family. And she took me down to the bus depot, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron. And she put Doc Smith's name and address in my grimy little paw, and told me goodbye. So that's how I met my sponsor. I went down to meet Doc. And I shall never forget that meeting with him. It was cold weather. It was zero. And he wasn't in his office when I got there, and I had to wait for him for what seemed to be an awful long period of time. And I'd walk up and down that corridor in front of his office. I was afraid to leave the place because I thought I'd get out on a semi, I might get picked up. And it was good and warm in there anyway, so I might as well stay to leave pain. But every time I passed his door, I'd read on the door his name, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon. Now, I'm going down to get fixed. This certainly seemed like a new approach to the problem. Finally, Doc came. And any of you folks who knew Doc, and there are people here who had that pleasure and that privilege, they know him to be a tall, angular fellow. He way tall, thin, and he had fingers on him this long. He was a man made for his profession. But you know, this fellow scared me to death. He ushered me in through his two offices into the back and sat me down there, and I got prepared to tell him all about my symptoms. But the thing about it is, he took the ball away from me and started telling me all about me. And something happened up here in this blubber of mine. I couldn't figure out how this guy knew so much about me. And then something occurred to me that frightened me, really scared me to death. Now, Dewey and anyone from Cleveland here will well remember this incident. Years ago, they had a thing going on in Cleveland that the newspaper men had a great time about. They had more fun with that than they had with this Watergate deal. And there was somebody that was working down at Kingsbury Run, which was a hobo hangout. And what they were doing is somebody down there was sneaking these hobos away when he's asleep and cutting all up in little pieces. And they used to find these pieces of bodies all over the place wrapped in newspaper. They found, I think, 7 bodies all together, and they never identified but only one of them to some fingerprints. And then newspaper boys were conjecturing that either this was a butcher was doing this, or it was some surgeon who'd gone a little bit wacky and was getting his jollies out of cutting people up. And they nicknamed this killer who they were trying to locate as the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. Now, Johnny and Dewey will remember this incident, I'm sure. I don't see how they can forget it. So Doc is talking to me and telling me all about myself. And how does this guy know all this stuff, Dewey? And the next thing he does, here's what killed me with him. He wanted to put me out in some goon loop out in Cuyahoga Falls where no one could get out me. About this time, I got through here that he's the Mad Butcher. He's been following me around, and he knows all this about me. I'm his next victim. And when he wants to put me someplace where nobody can get at me, I want to be somewhere where everybody can get at me. So I ran out of his office, my first opportunity, and I never stopped for elevators. I went down those 7 floors, bing, 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 and out of that building. And away I disappeared. So I couldn't forget this man. Now, I want to point this out for this reason. I want to demonstrate how serious I was about quitting drinking. I went back home, and I resumed my social amenities with my Jughead gang, and I was getting boozed up with all the time. We were sitting around one day in a habitat, and we got to talking about quitting drinking. I think I initiated this conversation, and I made this broad, bland statement that I was going to quit drinking. Now, here's something that drove me into this fellowship. There's one guy sitting there, a flannel-mouthed Irishman, and he's drunk, too. And when I announced that I was going to quit drinking, he turns on me and says, "You'll quit drinking? You'll never quit drinking. You haven't got guts enough to quit drinking." He says, "You're no damn good. You'll never quit." And he's drunk, too, of course. I says, "I am going to quit drinking. I'll show you." He says, "You show me. You can't show anybody anything." I says, "I know a doctor down in Akron that can fix me." He says, "No doctor can fix you. You're no damn good." He says, "You know, to quit drinking," he says, "takes determination. And to have determination, you need a chin." He says, "Look at you. You got a chin like Andy Gump. You're no damn good." I says, "Well, I'll show you." He says, "You go ahead and show me." So I got a hold of someone's telephone. I'm sure we didn't have telephone service in our little layout there. So whose phone I got, I don't know, but I got someone's because these were long-distance calls. And Doc told me I called him numerous times. I don't remember that. I remember talking to him once. And he told me to meet him at Akron City Hospital the next morning. And at Akron City Hospital, I was the next morning. I shall never forget that day. There was another zero blizzard going on out there in Akron when I got off that bus. And I didn't have the fare to get out to this hospital, and I had to walk out to this Akron City Hospital. And I know there's people here who've been in Akron, and they call that the city of 7 hills. Well, it's all hills, and every hill is up.
There's no downhill, Stephen. I had to walk up these hills to get out of this hospital. Now you picture this. It's zero. I don't have an overcoat, nothing. And I walked out there. When I got out to that hospital, I was sweating. And when I walked into the lobby of this hospital, I fainted dead away, passed out. I didn't know anything until I came to, and I'm up in a room, there's a lot of commotion around, and they're giving me a bath for some reason or other. And a lot of people around me, I seem to be the center of attraction. And people, all kinds of people there. And I opened my eyes, I looked around, and one of the very first things I saw when I opened my eyes was over on that windowsill was a bottle of rub. And I thought, oh boy, I'm down here to quit drinking, but if worse gets to worse and I start hearing music, there's my answer on that windowsill. And I figured there'd be a bottle of rub in probably in every room on that floor. So anything that happened, I had deathly fear of DTs. I never had them, but some of my drug buddies had them, and we had some experiences with them before, and I didn't want them. And I knew what the earmarks were. So I'd have had some of that rub, all right. So when comes this nurse with the tray, I can remember this. Two glasses on this tray. One was some white stuff, and the other was a nice, great big hooker of whiskey. But she said, Mr. Snyder, we have some medicine for you. You take this medicine and drink this whiskey after it, and it'll do you a lot of good. And I knew what that medicine was. That was formaldehyde. It tastes like the bottom of a bird cage. But it really can put you to sleep. So I cussed her out. I said, I came down here to quit drinking, not to drink any of your booze or anything else. So I didn't take the drink. What a smart guy I was, you know. So I have never had a drink since the day before I went to that hospital, which was the 11th day of February, 1938. I want to say this. I stayed in the hospital a week, and you can't tell me anything about shaking out a drunk. I'd been drunk for some years. I was not a periodic drinker. I was a chronic. I was drunk all the time. And when one quit after all those years, believe me, I went through hell. And I can't forget it. And I can feel for any person that's doing that. But anyway, that doesn't make me a hero. I'm more of a damn fool. I should have taken that drink. Even more humane to myself. But anyway, I'm glad I never have had one. I weighed 130 pounds when I was in that hospital. Wasn't much to me. I hadn't eaten in a long time. I didn't eat all the time I was in that hospital for a week. I remember this very well. Because the last day I was in that hospital, Paul Stanley came in the morning, and he got my breakfast. He ate my breakfast for me. He was there at lunch and got my lunch. I got the dessert. I got the peach that he was getting for dessert. He ate the rest of it. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, Doc came in as usual. People call him Dr. Bob. He's always Doc Smith to us. Doc came in and sat on the foot of my bed as was his usual custom, a very unprofessional posture, but he always did it. And he always stood there for a minute and looked at me. I always had a feeling that man could look right through me. I believe he could. Well, he says, young fellow, what do you think of all this? All these men have come and visited me while I was in the hospital, and they told me the stories of their careers, their drinking careers. They were all older men than I was. They were all fellows 40 to 50 years old enough. And I had just hit 35 at the time. I said, well, Doc, I said, I do not think this is great. These men came in talking to me to tell me the story of their life and tell me all about what happened to them with booze. And I know they're all 24-carat rummy. But I said, I'm puzzled about one thing. He says, and what's that?
I said, well, these fellows all tell me they have the answer to my problem if they don't tell me what the answer is. I've been here a week. What happens now? What are you going to do to me now? What do I have to do? What's the answer to this whole thing? He says, well, young fellow, he says, we don't know about you. You're pretty young. And we haven't had any luck with young fellows. They're all screwballs. He says, we're not too sure that you're ready for this yet. My God, ready for this yet? What do you have to do to be ready? I had no home, I had no money, I had no clothes, I didn't know where I was going when I was at hospital. I had no friends, I had nothing, period. So I had a conviction I was ready. What sort of different approach than what people get to do, you know? A lot of things have changed. People have an idea that change is great, and so many people try to change this program. Damn, we don't need this program change. These people got to change themselves. That's what we need. Anyway, Doc thought that I probably wasn't ready. I had to convince him. I said, well, Dick, I finally did. And he said, well, he says, young fellow, I'll give you the answer to this. So he turns around and points his big long bone finger at me. And he says, young fella, he says, do you believe in God? Well, believe me, that's the last thing I wanted to hear from a doctor. I had gone the mission route during my career, and I wanted no part of this. And when I heard this, I thought, oh my God in heaven, here I am in a hospital, and I'm obligated to a bunch of religious nuts. See? And I had to evade this question. But you don't evade, Doc. He's waiting for his answer. Oh, do I believe in God? And he says, well, I said, what does that have to do with it? I thought that was a real smart rejoinder. He said, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or don't you believe in God? Boy, he wants any business. Well, the next smart one I come up with is, well, I guess I do. The big bony finger again. There's no guessing about it, you're doing it, don't. This is the way they gave the Spirit the foundation of AA today. I finally had a great time to admit that I did. He says, well, that's fine. Now we can get someplace. He says, get out of that bed. I said, so what? Sit down on your knees. I said, so what? He says, we're going to pray. I said, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I said, I don't know anything about praying. He said, I don't suppose you do. But you get down there just the same. I'll pray and you can repeat after me. That'll be good for this time. So he bounces me out of that nice warm nest on the cold concrete floor in my shorty nighties. And he utters a prayer, and I repeated it. I don't know what it was. But I do remember this, that after he concluded, he shook hands with me. And he said, young fellow, you're going to be all right. And that night he carried me to a meeting. This was not a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't born yet. This is a meeting of the Oxford Movement at King Henry's home in Akron, Ohio. That's where Doc had been going to meetings, and that's where he took his boys and he sobered them up. The alcoholics in the Oxford Movement were a minority. They were not the majority. The Oxford Movement were a bunch of people trying to live better lives by the application of Christian principles and living by guidance. And they figured that with their plan of life, they could fix everybody. And they took on alcoholics, and that was the first big mistake they ever made. They kind of overreached themselves. But they were doing pretty well, though. They were getting along. There was about 40 people around that had been exposed to this plan by the time I arrived, 40 alcoholics. So I attended meetings of the Oxford Movement for 15 months in Akron, Ohio. I'd go back to Cleveland. I'd run down there every Wednesday to meetings, and I'd go to be down on weekends to be around these people. They were the first people that showed me any love and concern. And I stuck to those people like glue. Well, anyway, this doc told me that I would spend the rest of my life working with alcoholics because I have a talent for it. Being an alcoholic, you can help alcoholics. Other people are not successful with it. So I am to spend my life doing this as an avocation, not as a profession. And all these years I've been following this out. Well, believe me, I used to envy those men down in Akron. I used to think they were the greatest things that ever happened since the invention of the wheel or the discovery of fire. I used to just actually worship these fellows. I'd do anything they'd tell me. We didn't have suggestions in those days. This is a word that's coming to AA. I don't know. You know, an AA can screw up anything. You get a bunch of alcoholics to make a screw up a two-car funeral. I hear them talking about the 12 suggested steps. It says nothing about 12 suggested steps. It says these are the 12 steps which are suggested as a means of recovery. If they turn this around, you could just suggest it and take them or leave them. And that's just the trouble. A lot of people take that literally. They take them or leave them and they wind up in the bathrobe again. These steps are anything but suggested. And I'll explain this later. Well, anyway, I'm told to go out in the world and to get these drunks. So the first thing I do, I go back to my buddies. And I tell them they should quit drinking, they should be like me. And they look at me and they don't want to be like me. I learned very early in life that a prophet is without honor in his own home. So I had to go on the highways and the byways, and I became the first and foremost barstool snatcher in AA history. I went every place where there were rummy, and believe me, it was a virgin territory. Up to this time, there had never been anything outside of things like the Samaritan Cure and the Steely Cure and some of those aversion cure dumps that were used to fix rummies, and they didn't usually half kill them, but they didn't do much fixing. But here was a plan to help rummies, and I was told to go out and fix these rummies. Believe me, I don't know how I ever lasted, but it took me 7 long months before I got my first rummy in the hospital. And this was after diligent effort, lots of ambition, but no sense. I talked to thousands of rummies, really, collectively and individually. I'd lay down with them, I'd stand up with them, anything. I finally found one, and I could write a book about that first rummy I ever got. It was a rare experience. I wish I had the time to tell you about it tonight. It's terrific. But I finally got this guy and got him in the hospital in Akron. And believe me, I was walking on air after this happened because I figured now I am really a member. I have arrived. I can look back and see why it took me 7 long months to get that fellow. I was carrying a message, supposedly, but I had no message. This is one of my big problems today. A lot of people are running helter-skelter all over Hell's Half Acre after rummies, carrying some message they don't have. There's a time when we're supposed to do this, according to our program. There's something about that in a 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. But people come in, and the first thing you know, they're out there sponsoring 9 people. With what? What kind of a message? I found that after this first fellow, the next one came quite rapidly. And eventually we had about 12 rummies going down Akron, each week from Cleveland. Now, here's where AA started. Here's some history you do not read in the literature that's approved. We were going down. All of these men, I had told them that this program of recovery would not interfere in any way with their religious beliefs that they had any, nor with anything that had to do with the church that they had one. And as it happened, 8 of these first dozen men happened to be Roman Catholics. And I told these fellows they wouldn't interfere. The last format of the meeting in the Oxford movement was like this. First of all, before the meeting started, they had a guidance meeting where some people went down in P. Henry's recreation room and had a quiet time for a half an hour. And they were supposed to get guidance. They all took pads and pencils and whatever came through in the meditation, they write it down. And this is how a leader of the meeting was chosen for the night, through guidance. Then when the meeting started, the leader was tapped, and he thought that was a great privilege to lead the meeting. And the format was this. He was to open the meeting with an audible prayer. Then he was to read scripture, any scripture he was guided to read, or any of his favorite passages or verses or chapters. Read as much as he wanted, or he felt inclined to. And this was out of the King James Version, if you please. And he's Irish, you look at this guy. The next thing you know, after he was through reading his scripture, the leader witnesses, and he tells all about his sins, and how he has met with them and overcome them, or what has happened about them. After he runs out of gas, the other people in the room, in the audience, they get up and do their witnessing. And it gets pretty sticky sometimes. This is all right. It's good. I'm not criticizing people in that way, but I'm just mentioning. When you've told a bunch of people this is not going to interfere with the religion, you're getting yourself in pretty hot soup. Because they look at this performance, they look at each other, they look at me. And I get static all the way back to Cleveland that night. But something had to give. In the fall of 1938, we wrote these AA books. You notice what I said about that? We wrote that book. This book was not written by one person. It's a conglomerated effort of a lot of people. And they were not all Alfies either. Okay, but most of them were. Well, anyway, with this book, we devised a program of 12 steps. We did not have these 12 steps in the Oxford movement. They had the same plan. They called, the Oxford movement called their plan a life-changing program. It involved an admittance of a need for a change in their life. It involved admitting to a God. It involved a surrender of our life and will to God. And it involved living according to the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And it involved missionary work, going out and converting other people. When the 12 steps were written, they would simplify this program so that an alcoholic, no matter what his belief was or if he had very little of any, he could accept this program, as long as he believed in a higher power. It would not interfere with anyone's religion and the setup. So I'm having this problem with all these Catholic boys. But they didn't have this problem in Akron. They had no Catholics in the Oxford group in Akron. Only one man who'd ever been a Catholic was old Phil Smith. Phil had, was a fallen away Catholic, but Smitty was screwed up anyway. And he never could catch on. By the time he got mixed up with people in Hindus and in Christian Science and all the other denominations and this Oxford group, he was more screwed up than ever. This guy didn't have a chance. Eventually, the poor guy died. But he was the only fellow who was closely related to Catholicism in the Akron outfit. And we had a preponderance of them in Cleveland. So we had to do something. The best thing I could think of was to go and talk to my sponsor about it, which I did. Went down and talked to Doc and told him what our problem was. He says, well, we're not keeping them out. I says, no, you're not keeping them out. They should keep them out. He says, well, that's tough. I says, no, that's tough. We have a program now of 12 steps and 4 absolutes, and that's all we need.
We don't need all this other falder off. Getting guidance for other people and all that sort of thing. And open confession.
He says, well, we can't do anything about that. I says, oh, yes, we can. He says, like what? I says, oh, you wait and see what, like what? If you're not going to change here, we'll change.
Had another rummy, another Irishman, if you please, in the hospital at the time. In fact, Bill Wilson helped me put him in. Bill came to visit me one time, and I was going out to call on old Al Goldrick. And I says, Bill, up to me, you're going to have to come along, because I got to see this guy tonight. I think he's right.
He says, oh, hell, I don't want to go out.
I says, well, come on. I want to go back and talk to you. I got to see him.
So he went with me. I had wrestled with this bird for all winter long. But Bill had something to offer him and convinced the guy, and he decided to go down the next morning. In fact, Bill took him down to Akron for him, which was great. Well, I was in the hospital when this was taking place, and I went out to see Al's wife, Grace, whom I met long before I ever met Al, and told her our problem, and could we use her home for a meeting hall. She had a big home. They were losing it, but they still had it. And she was delighted to use her house for a meeting. The next week, I went down to Akron and made the announcement. I said, this is the last week that the Alkies from Cleveland will be down here in a body. We are going to start our own group in Cleveland next Thursday night at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. And this is not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. And only alcoholics and their immediately interested families are welcome. Nobody else. So you can imagine what happened. The roof went off the house. This was the first riot we ever had in AA. This was the first display of unity. AA was born in a riot, and it grows in riots. We had one hell of a night there. They said, Clarence, you can't do this. Well, it's done. Well, come down and talk this over. There's nothing to talk about. We've done it. Well, if I thought that was a rough night, you should have seen next Thursday night. They all came up in a body and crashed our meeting and tried to break it up. And one fellow was going to whip me. And these were good Christian people, however. But some other people got between us and probably saved my skin. So we held our ground, and that's the way we started. And we started building our group, and we started to grow. It wasn't too long afterwards that we got those terrific articles in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. So we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of inquiries from all over the country. This is what put AA on the map. This is stuff you don't read, but this is history. Finally, after 6 months, if I thought we had a riot in Akron, and if I thought we had a riot at our first meeting, you should see what happened in 6 months in Cleveland. We had more unity. And we unified into three groups instead of two. We had an awful riot, and they voted me out of AA. I am the first guy, I have a lot of firsts. I was the first guy ever voted out of AA. But a lot of other people didn't agree with it, so that's where the riot came in. So we split in three groups. Two on the east side and one on the west side. And from those groups, others have broken off, so they have several hundred of them up there now. Thousands and thousands of rummies. Now this is miraculous. I look back on these days, those early days of this fellowship, and I think back and I look at that guy back there who was me. It's impossible. It couldn't be. He couldn't have done this. He couldn't have done that. And it's true, I couldn't have done it. I take no credit for these things. I've learned, and I learned long ago, that whatever we do, we're only agents being used. To Because the things that I had occurred to me in the early days of my AA career, in the first few years, I had absolutely no capacity to perform of myself. This is true. It was very humbling. The things that I did and people I met who I had to be with, it's unbelievable when I look back on it. But I had to be directed, God directed, because I didn't have that much sense. I didn't have that much strength. I didn't have that much influence. I didn't have that much education. I didn't have anything like that. But it would ordinarily be ascribed to a person who's supposed to really get some movement. I had an awful lot of enthusiasm, and I had very strong convictions about things. I'm a Dutchman, and I got a hard head. And when I get something in my nut, it takes an awful lot to kick it out. And there's some things I got in my head very early in my career, put there by my sponsor and other people who took interest in me, that you couldn't beat out of my head with an axe. They're still there. I learned a lot of things from people in that old Oxford group. I learned more things after meetings than I think than I ever learned during meetings, because a lot of this stuff confused me during meetings. I hear people talk in AA, they say they've never been to a bad meeting. Boy, I've been to some stinkeroos. Believe me, they've never heard a bad lead. Oh boy, I don't know where they've been all this time. And I heard some awful ones. I've heard thousands of meetings, too. In 35 years, you do. You hear a lot of them. But anyway, people taught me a good deal. They took an interest in me, and I stuck with those fellows like glue. And I'll never forget one thing that happened to me. I like to always talk about this, because here's the thing that probably did more to change my life than any one thing during my career down in Akron. Every night after a meeting, this big fella, Bill Van Horn, he's a great, big, rough, tough character. Bill had preceded me in the group by 6 months. Bill had a pension from the First World War. And every month when he'd get his pension, he'd go berserk. He'd get drunk, and he used to like to fight policemen. And he never seemed to get the idea in his head that he couldn't win. There's just too damn many of them. But he would do it. And finally, his family got tired of this, and they thought for his own good, they put him away. So they probated him and had him put in the Maslin State Insane Asylum. And there he was, and that's where Doc found him, Doc Smith. And Doc took him out of that nut factory and put him in the group, and Bill never had another drink the rest of his life. Now, this was a big, rough, tough guy. Somehow or other, he took an awful shine to me, and he used to always get me in a corner after meetings and talk to me. And I'll tell you the truth, I was about half scared of this guy, too. He's a big guy, and he come out of a nut factory, and, you know, I could expect anything. So one night he got me in a corner and he said, Clarence, he says, I'm going to give you the answer to this whole ball of wax. He says, I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it. And I don't want you to ever forget it. So this is the answer. So I can still see Bill like it's last night. He's standing there at a library table in T. Henry's living room. He takes out his billfold and he starts taking all these papers and pictures and cards and all this debris out of it and piling it on this little table. So finally he finds what he's looking for, and it's a slip of paper, and he holds it up to me. And I take this slip and I look at it, and here it's a Bible verse. And I look at that, and I look at this big gorilla. Oh boy, he is going. But I did what Bill told me to do. I did memorize it. And I have not forgotten it. And it was one of my very favorite verses in the good book. And the 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, the 17th verse. And I read it this way. Therefore,
If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new.
How about that?
If any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. What about your life here? Is it anything like it used to be? Is there a person sitting in this room who has the same life he had before he came here? Look at this gang sitting out here all dressed up and shined up, beautiful, like this mayor said a while ago. You're beautiful people. You are. Just think what this crowd would do if you'd all fall at a sudden right now. It'd revert. Just finish. Talk about earthquakes and fires. That would be child's play. They could move this arena here down to Los Angeles. Every person here has been touched with something. I'm so convinced of that. In this fellowship, we didn't have the big book. We didn't have the literature. We didn't have any of the nice things you have today. So we were taught out of the good book. My sponsor used to teach me out of the Bible. I'd ask him a question, and he'd say, well, what does it say in the good book? I'd say, how do I know? You're the teacher who tell me. He'd say, read it and find out. That's a sponsorship. He said, the Bible has an answer for every human problem, everything you need. I'd ask him a question. I remember one time, for instance, I said, what's the meaning of all this first things first business? What does that mean? Tell me. He says, what does it say in the book? I said, how do I know? He says, read and find out. I said, you tell me. He says, well, first things first means this. It says very plainly in that Bible, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Okay? First thing first. Does that ever occur to you? This is the kind of teaching they gave me. I'm not teaching a Sunday school class up here. I'm telling you what happened to me when I came here. I hear a lot of people talking about what happened to them in AA and before they got here. This is how they taught me. You know, it's a funny doggone thing. I've been sober for over 35 years. Maybe there's something to the way they taught me. You know? I learned early in my career that our whole entire AA program came from the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of James. I was also taught that every experience and everything we needed, we could learn from reading that book, that good book. He even told me about slippers. There's a piece in the Bible that explains why slippers have such an awful bad time coming back. When some person comes to AA and he has the benefit of this way of life for some time, and then he reverts and goes back, something happens to him. And there's a piece in the good book about that. And you find it both in Luke and in Matthew. But it has to do with the unclean spirit. It says, when the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places seeking rest. And finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept clean and garnished. See? Then he goeth and taketh with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. And the last estate of that man is worse than the first. How about that? People say, why does a person have such a time when he has the benefit of it, and then he turns his back on it? Seven other spirits come in, and the last estate of that man is worse than the first. I've seen this happen. Believe me, I know two fellows. Dewey and Johnny know these two fellows. They had over 30 years of sobriety and have gotten drunk. And there are reasons why they got drunk. There are reasons why anybody gets drunk after they have had this benefit. And I know the reasons for these fellas, and I pray for them. And I hope they can come back. But their chances of recovery are so remote. Because it takes so much to get those seven other ones out of their house again. See? It's pitiful. 30 years these boys have, both of them. And both of them are smart fellas, sharp. Made great successes of their life during the 30 years they were sober, both of them. One fellow moved out of town and he moved to a small town over in another state, away from all these people in AA whom he spent 30 good years with. And he got fancy and he joined a lot of clubs and he forgot all about trying to carry any message over there. He got interested in a lot of earth people. And you know, when they get interested this way and they change, he gets to the idea that he gets thinking. Now, this is the worst thing an alcoholic can ever do, is get thinking. I hear people talk about coming in here and changing their thinking. God help them. Because what does an alcoholic have to think with when he gets here? If he has anything to think with, he wouldn't be here. An alcoholic don't think. One of the worst things that ever happened in AA was some dodo that I know and know him very well. He got a hold of a whole crate of these signs, think. He got them from the IBM company. They used to send around to all their customers. And this guy thought that this would be a great idea, send around to all the groups so he can have in their clubhouses and on their podiums and all this stuff. Think. Well, that's one heck of a thing to confront a rummy with when he walks into AA. If he just dumped a rummy don't think. You know the big difference between a rummy and an earth person? The outstanding difference is this. Earth people think, and rummies feel. If you put a sign there, feel, that'd be something. No think. It takes about 3 years of consistent effort and a lot of good counseling and a lot of trying and a lot of reading and a lot of studying and a lot of application for an alcoholic coming to AA to even begin to get a little bit logical. We're the most illogical people in the world. I get a kick out of some of the brethren that come in here and talk about their second step and start something about restoring them to sanity. He says, I'm not nuts. You aren't? Well, what are you doing here? You're not nuts. How about these periodic drunks? Well, you know, there's two kinds of rummies. There's a periodic and there's a chronic. I was a chronic. I drank all the time. People knew what to expect of me. I was consistent. But take these periodics. Those are the people that ought to be barred. They are something else. What do they do? They're the first ones that'll squawk about insanity, too. They'll get themselves a good job. A nice house, nice car, nice wife, nice family, nice furniture. Everything is going good and they're advancing in business and going swell. And all of a sudden, boom, they blow the whole bundle. And they get drunk and the job goes, the family goes, the car goes, the furniture goes, everything goes and they wind up a bum. So what does this guy do? He gets another job. Usually a better one than he had. See? Gets another nice wife, another nice house, another nice job, nice furniture, nice car, everything good, and he joins the Chamber of Commerce, and he joins the KSD and the Masons and everybody. And the next thing you know, blows that all to hell. And this guy tells me he shivers when you mention insanity to him. Believe me, when they told me I was nuts, I welcomed that. Because it got me off the hook for a lot of things. Yes, sir. This thing of working with alcoholics is a wonderful experience. And we learn things. But we learn to live with one another, and we learn what life is all about. We learn what's important. But alcoholics, this society of ours, you and I are the most blessed of all people. We are all, it's a miracle that any of us are here. I always like to mention this. Alcoholism has been with us as long as time has been recorded. We read about alcoholism in ancient history. We read about it in mythology. We read about it in the Bible. A lot of good rummy stories in the Bible. I think last time I was here, I told you a few of them. Some terrific rummy stories. You want to hear one or two? The first rummy story in the Bible, you'll find in the first book of the Bible, in Genesis. Read the story of Noah and the ark. Boy, did he ever get potted on that ark. And who but a rummy would ever do a thing that he did? And I'd just like to know why he didn't swat one of those flies. One of the greatest rummy stories is the story of the Jericho Road, the Good Samaritan. Here is a rummy story to stop all rummy stories. Picture this. This bird lying out there in the middle of the road, he's stripped, he's naked, he's all beat up and he's half dead. He's lying out there in the road. Along comes a priest and he sees him there and he recognizes what it is. He's a drunk. And all that's happened to him, he's got beat up and rolled. They rolled him. He has nothing. He's lying out there all beat up, half dead. So the priest, this is no concern of his. He's not going to get involved, so he crosses the street on the other side and passes by. Along comes a Levite. Likewise, he sees this rummy lying out there in the road all beat up and rolled. He does the same thing. He's not going to get involved. It's nothing to him. So he passes by. But aha, here comes this next guy, the Samaritan. The Samaritans were not the favored people in those days. But this fellow is a traveling salesman. You don't believe it? I'll prove it to you. And likewise, he's a rummy. This is a rummy salesman. There's a lot of them. He sees this bird. He recognizes the earmarks immediately. And that's the brother under the skin lying out there. So he gets down off of his form of conveyance, which certainly wasn't a Chevrolet, it was probably a mule. And he got down there, and what does it say he did for that guy? He gave him a drink. Read that story. He gave him some wine, and he administered to him, and he put him on his form of conveyance, and what did he do? He took him to an inn, a hotel. Here's how I know the whole ball of wax comes out now. So he says to this innkeeper, he says, here, take care of this fellow. And here's some money. You notice he gave the money to the innkeeper, not the rummy. He says, take care of this fellow. And here's how I know he's a traveling salesman. He says, if any more be due, I will repay you next time I come by. He's traveling the territory. There's the first AA call on record. These are the things I was taught. These are the things which are meaningful to me in my beginnings in this fellowship. I was taught something about prayer and meditation. I was taught something about how to work with people and how people should be worked with. And I was taught never to go out on an AA errand without first being prepared through prayer. This might be the reason a lot of people that I have known have stayed sober for 30-some-odd years. When I think about that. I was in AA a long time before, in this fellowship a long time before I found out anybody ever slips and has trouble. This shook me very badly when I found out people do fall off of this. I never figured they would, but some did. I made it my business. I'm not like the guy. I hear people say, well, if you have somebody give you a watch, you don't take it apart to see what it runs and make it run. The hell I don't. I wanted to find out why these people got drunk. So when they got drunk, I went out to see them and talk to them and find out why they got drunk. Because I thought it was impossible that anyone would ever get drunk again when he'd embrace this program. So I found out the reasons. There are a few reasons. Most reasons are based on selfishness and neglect. The sins of omission, not commission. We change our sense of values, and we forget where we started and what gave us the opportunity to be here. Other things become more important to us than the fundamentals we were taught in AA. It's insidious, and we must constantly guard against this. And the only way I know to guard against it is not fear it, but to improve ourselves. Once we take this program and we accept it and we apply it, from that point on, it's imperative that we grow in three areas of our life, mentally, morally, and spiritually. If we never forget this, we'll never have trouble. Now, say another thing. I'll give you another ironclad guarantee. If we come to AA and we accept this program and apply it to our lives, the first 9 steps of this program, our life will change, and we can keep it changed very simply. One of the greatest ways of keeping this program, keeping ourselves changed into a good attitude, is by using our 10th step every night, every day of our life. A daily check on ourselves. And this is something that most people overlook. I hear people talk about these inventory steps, and they get this 4th step all screwed up with the 10th step, and there's no relationship to the two of them at all. The 4th step says something about taking a moral inventory, searching and fearless moral inventory. It's we're trying to find out what we have to live with and to get along with and what's left to us and what assets and liabilities we have. The 10th step doesn't say that. It says we're taking a personal inventory. That's a check on our daily activity. I keep my program very simple. I'm not smart enough to have a complicated program. And my 10th step is very simple. I will share it with you. I do this every night. This has been going on for years, and it's habitual with me. Last thing after I'm in bed and I'm alone, this is my prayer time. And I think about my day, what I've done, who I've been with, and who I've seen, and what has occurred. Sometimes some of the things I've done today I'm not too proud of, and sometimes I've offended someone. I don't really mean to, but I do it sometimes. You're bound to when you're dealing with people. I'm a salesman, and I've often said that I think there should be a day put aside every year when a salesman can shoot people with impunity. I have some friends in the profession, and it's true. People can really get to you sometimes. But anyway, I think about my day. Do I have any apologies to make? I don't waste any time getting it done. And you know why? It isn't big things that cause
an alcoholic to go bad in AA. It's little things. I've seen some tremendous disasters happen to people in AA in their personal lives. They didn't get drunk over it. Seen some awful tragedies occur. They didn't get drunk. But I've seen people like these two boys I mentioned a while ago, 30 years in AA, get drunk. Why? Little things. It's the little things that throw us. And if we don't take care of these little things, day by day, they grow and they get too much for us to carry. And they change our sense of values. We start excusing ourselves from this and from that, and we don't face issues. And we get into a different world again. These are the little things that we should take care of every day with our 10th step. It's a tremendous step, and don't ever get it confused with number 4. Because this is one of the living steps. We have 3 living steps, 10th, 11th, and 12th. We keep ourselves straight by 10. We learn how to pray and what to pray for in 11. And the 12th tells us something else about what we should be doing. Our 11th step is a tremendous step because it leads us into a prayer life. Listen to this step, what it says. Try to absorb this. It says something in our 11th step that we're seeking something, that we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. A lot of words, isn't it? What does it mean? We're seeking something. Through prayer and meditation. Just what does that mean? To me, prayer is talking to God, and meditation is listening to Him. I've often said that the good Lord gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth. That should suggest something to us in our prayer life. We sought through prayer and meditation. What are we seeking? To improve our conscious contact with God by talking to Him and listening to Him. I can feel that He's as close to me as you are. See? Not way out in the blue yonder, we are unattainable. Right here. The good book says He's closer than hands and feet, and that's awful close. So we're learning how to communicate with Him since we turned our will and our life over to Him in the 3rd step. Don't ever forget that 3rd step. That's the one that separates the men from the boys. That 3rd step determines whether we're in AA or we're around AA. That's the deal. So we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Now it tells us what we're praying for. A lot of people, they get up in the morning, they pray for sobriety. Don't pray for sobriety. You have sobriety. Thank Him for it at night. Pray for strength, guidance, and direction. What do you want me to do, God? I am your servant. I have turned my will and my life over to you. You're running my life. What do you want me to do? This is what the 11th step means. This is what it meant back in the old Oxford group. That's what it means in AA. In AA, we have 200 well-chosen words, which we call the 12 steps, and that's our program. It's no use changing it. It's no use screwing it up. It's infallible if we'll use it. If we'll use it. Our program is so simple, but people complicated. I hear people talking about this program. They want to know when they should take this step and when they want to take that step, when they should do that. They ask me these questions. I say, well, when do you want to get well? Okay. This week? Our program of 12 steps is a prescription for living. Supposing you get sick, very desperately ill, and you call a doctor in, and he looks you over and gives you an examination, so he sits down and writes out a prescription for you with 12 ingredients in it. Well, you know enough about Latin, maybe, to recognize several things that he's written on there out of these 12 things. And you look at this one thing, and, well, I don't like that stuff. It's sour. And this other item here, I don't like that because it makes me belch. And this other stuff always gives me a headache. So there's three or four things in there that I don't like in that prescription. That other stuff's all right. It don't bother me much. So I take this prescription to the druggist. Say, hey, Mr. Druggist, the doctor gave me this stuff, but I don't want you to put this stuff in because it makes me belch. And this stuff here gives me a headache. This other stuff makes me sneeze. Or anything. So I just leave that stuff out. So he fills the prescription minus these three or four ingredients. Do you think you're going to get well? By what rules of common sense, if any, does a person think he can get well by taking this prescription for a living of the 12 steps and doing as he damn pleases with it? These steps are numbered 1 to 12. They say, well, what? How should I take them? I mean, which one should I take first? Can you count? Very simple. But as I say, an alcoholic has the greatest capacity for screwing up the detail. We have an opportunity to make a real life for ourselves, and in spite of anything, we'll try to screw it up. We'll change this thing around. We get a lot of encouragement to do this from some sources in our own fellowship, too, let me say. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. But actually, we'll always remember that we're here to learn how to live according to the way the good Lord wants us to live, and we're here to serve. And we're here to improve ourselves so that we can serve better. If we only retain the simplicity of our 12-step program, and remember this is a way of life, it's a changed life. In closing, I want to read something. It's very interesting and always has been and important to me. This is the last talk that my sponsor made before he died. He's just with to live a couple of months, a few weeks after he made this talk. He made this talk in Cleveland, Ohio on Sunday, July 30th, 1950. Doc Smith. He said, my good friends in AA and of AA, I feel I would be very remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to welcome you here to Cleveland, not only to this meeting, but those that have already transpired. I hope very much that the presence of so many people and the words that you have heard will prove an inspiration to you. Not only to you, but may you be able to impart that inspiration to the boys and girls back home who were not fortunate enough to be able to come. In other words, we hope that your visit here has been both enjoyable and profitable. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing that I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. That's important. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength hasn't returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let's also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue. And if we must use it, let us use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. And thank you very much. That is from my side.